Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Today, meteorologist Jason Goff joins us on the line to answer your questions. Jason now runs a forecasting website at jasonsweather.com. You've seen him on TV in these parts of the country for a long period of time. Always great to have Jason on the program. I love to complain about the weather, and he's the number one go-to guy that I blame about all weather conditions. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. The weather, meteorologist Jason Goff, your weather calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today on the line is meteorologist Jason Goff, here to answer your weather questions. Formerly of News Channel 13 in Albany, Jason's forecasts have been on the air around these parts for a long time. He now runs a forecasting website, which is very cool, jasonsweather.com. If you have a question about the weather, call us, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Mr. Jason Goff, how are you?
Hey, Ray. Good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing?
Doing all right. You know, Hurricane Epsilon is going to sideswipe Bermuda sometime later today or tonight. My question for you first is, when did they run out of actual names? I mean, you got Ellie Mae, Enrico, Edsel, Epilady. You got a lot of E's.
Yeah, that is a fact. Well, basically what happens when you name hurricanes, the World Meteorological Organization comes up with the names. They're both male and female, and they are English, French, and Spanish. But it's not every letter. It's not every letter that is available. So, like, there's no X or Q or something like that. But when they run out, basically you start off with the Greek alphabet. And we've only done that once before. That was in 2005. That was, up until this year, the most active hurricane season. And then 2020 came along. Go figure. Who would have thought?
Well,
something unusual would have happened this year.
No, we've had several in the last couple of weeks, it seems. And this one looks like it's going to miss most of the damage that could have been done.
Yeah, and it grew into a major hurricane, a Category 3. So, you know, it's certainly a good thing that it is to the east of Bermuda, and it is staying away, going to be recurving out. I mean, you wouldn't want to be out, doing any fishing off the Grand Banks or anything like that. But at least for the island of Bermuda, they're in pretty good shape. The only other item of note is down in the Caribbean. Basically right smack in the middle of the Caribbean between Central America and Cuba, Jamaica, and all of that. And, you know, that's something that the Hurricane Center is going to be keeping an eye on. That is an area that is that tends to get a little frisky this time of year. So, you know, if you were living along the Gulf Coast, basically anywhere from, really anywhere, but certainly from, you know, Houston and points east, the farther east you go, the better opportunity you have. If you remember, we had in 2005, actually Wilma formed down there, and that was a Mac Daddy storm. That thing was nasty, and hopefully we won't have a repeat of that this year.
Meteorologist Jason Goff joins us today for a discussion about the weather on Vox Pop. You can call us if you wish, 800-348-2551. You're encouraged to do so, 800-348-2551. In reporting the news today about Epsilon, it struck me the massive power involved in even a Category 2 hurricane in that, you know, the northeast New England coast and Atlantic Canada coast, they're going to see storm surge and riptides based on this thing that is in Bermuda. It blows my mind.
It's really something else. And it's, you know, the scope of these things is like you can do the math, if you will, and, you know, and sit and crunch numbers and look and see how big the storm is and how how far out the hurricane force winds go and how far out the tropical storm force winds go and all that sort of thing. But to understand the scope of things, and I think that's why overall, not to get philosophical on you here, but that's that's a problem I think that a lot of people have, and to nobody's fault. It's just it's so difficult to grasp the enormity of our planet and the things that are on it. You know, even something like global warming, which we're not going to talk about today, obviously, because this is a weather show. But people have such a difficult time grasping that concept of global. And these storms are so big. And, you know, you can simulate what these things do if you can scale it down enough. And it really is amazing. It's just so amazing to see it on such a large scale. So you're absolutely right.
And that gets back to the point you and I have discussed many times, and that forecasting power equates to computing power, and it gets better all the time. So at some point, you guys are going to be, you know, 75-80% right all the time.
Well, that would be good. I mean, we're certainly well above that within a 24-hour period. We're more like in the 94-95%. But certainly to
long
have
range,
you know, and her, well, for the longer range especially, yeah, because you know, that's just a function of making sure that you don't buy into that old thing that, you know, that we heard when we were younger, Ray, when when computers were kind of just starting to come onto the scene and you heard that phrase garbage in, garbage out. You've got to make sure that you have enough data into the model. And not only that, that the data are good, because if they're no good, then your forecast is going to be no good as well. So, you know, it's when I used to go and visit schools, although I'm doing a Zoom call next month.
Oh, nice.
First, for my friends in the North Colony District. But I kind of explain it to the students like this. Like, let's say you were heading from North Carolina to Bermuda. Okay. No problems with the water. It's, you know, nice bathtub of an Atlantic. But if you take out from, you know, the Outer Banks or wherever, and you're off even 5 degrees. The first day, you know, that's not too bad. You're in pretty good shape. But then you project that out a few days, and all of a sudden, you're not going to Bermuda. You're going to Africa.
Yeah.
Because you're off, and those errors just get more and more protracted on down the line because they're feeding off of bad data. So that's kind of how that works.
Jason Goff is our guest today. Let's grab a call or two before our first break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Jason, I got a question for you. I don't know if this is true or not. A couple of times last winter, I was driving home from a couple of places, and I saw a couple of flickers in the sky, probably lightning. Is that kind of common in the winter to have lightning flash and thunder?
No. No, it's certainly not unheard of, especially if you live, near Lake Ontario in the winter. You see thunder. It's called thunder snow. But for us here, and I don't have the solid, I don't have the solid numbers to back this up. But I would say we might get, you know, in this area, you know, we might see lightning maybe once every, I'm just guessing, 3 or 4 years. So it's certainly not unheard of, but it's not an annual thing either.
And how does that happen, Jason? I remember one Christmas Eve that happening, and it was very striking to watch the storm, the snow coming down, lightning and thunder over Albany. And, you know, this probably goes back to the late 70s, early 80s.
Oh, yeah, and it's fascinating. And really it is. I mean, basically, when we talk about this just in general thunderstorm development, right, like you need two ingredients. If you can get them both together, then you can really get something cooked up. But you need dynamics and thermodynamics, okay? Thermodynamics, obviously, relating to heat. You tend to get those in the summertime when we talk about, you know, destabilization of the atmosphere in the afternoon and all of that. But if you've got enough dynamics aloft, you don't necessarily need all of that heat. And the lake effect snow is an extreme example of that because you have a ton of instability. You've got really cold air that's coming over relatively, you know, really warm water. And in essence, you're getting a lot of energy as a product of that, and it's enough to get thunderstorms going, or, you know, I shouldn't say thunderstorms per se, but you're going to be able to get a fair amount of lightning strikes, and it's over a small area, and it doesn't last very long, but it's still pretty wild to see. I mean, I remember the October storm of 1987.
Oh, yeah.
And being awakened by thunder at like 7:45 in the morning on a Sunday morning. And obviously, you know, for us to get snow that early in the month of October and to have it stick as it did, you've got to have some serious juice in the atmosphere. And certainly that's what we had. And it was enough to throw some lightning at us.
Chris, thanks for the call. We have to take a quick break here. Jason Goff joins us. It's Weather Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop, WAMC's call-in program. If you have a question for meteorologist Jason Goff, give us a call right now, 800-348-2551. Jason, how's the weather website going?
It's been going good, Ray. I actually, you know, I've got a really good partnership with the Times Union. I love working with those folks, and we had a call last week, and we're going to be breaking some things out here in the next couple of weeks, so be on the lookout for that. And, you know, it's been going good, man. I enjoy doing what I need to do, getting up in the morning, getting everybody's forecast together. And anybody that knows me, that watched me or that subscribes to my emails or listens to you and me on this show knows that I'm a big fan of the warm weather. So it's awfully nice to be able to forecast 70s in late October. I'll go ahead and tell you.
Do you think you'll ever retire to a nice warm spot?
Yes, there are a few certainties in life, Ray, but if I'm breathing, I will be heading south at some point in time. That is a fact. I enjoyed, you know, I grew up in Albany, but I couldn't wait to go to a warmer climate to go to college, which is what I did, and I'll eventually make my way back there. I mean, I love it up here in the summer, but the winters just can be a little long, that's all.
Jason Goff is our guest. Speaking of warm weather, let's go to tropical New Hampshire. Diana's in Keene. Go ahead.
Good afternoon on a glorious day. This is so exciting to talk to a meteorologist. Here's my question, Jason. With so many of us, we have these powerful weather tools in our pocket. How does the ability of everybody to just sort of be a meteorologist, how does that make your job easier and harder?
That is a great question.
Absolutely.
That's a great question. We do have, you know, more access to technology than we've ever had, obviously, you know, with smartphones and all of that. But the thing is that people, you know, you run into a couple of different roadblocks, if you will. One, just, you know, the amount of data that people get, you know, most people walking around aren't talking about going to, you know, weather websites and checking out different model ensembles. You know, they don't generally do that. So people tend to rely on apps for forecasting. And the apps are, how do I be polite about this? They're imperfect at best. How about that?
All right.
They're good if you want to know the temperature. There's a fantastic radar app out there that's top of the line called RadarScope. That's a really good one to have because you can access any National Weather Service radar site in the country, and then other sites around the world too, actually. So that's all really good. So, you know, and because like kind of what Ray and I were talking about before, there are still many things that need to be done to models to be able to forecast the weather, you know, even day by day, let alone hour by hour. And so, you know, fortunately for meteorologists, the need for us is not going away anytime soon. There are a lot of jobs that are going to be replaced by technology, but this will not be one of them because you still need people to interpret the weather models, use their experience, and, you know, just be able to relate to folks that need a forecast so that they can understand what they need to do, you know, to go about their daily lives.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling,
Diana. Does that make sense? Okay,
makes sense to me. Thank you. Jason Goff is our guest. It's Weather Today on Vox Pop. Mary Beth in Half Moon. Mary Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was interested in woolly bear caterpillars. I saw one the other day with much more brown in the middle than black on either end, and I'm just wondering how you feel about that for forecasting the winter.
Ah, yes.
Well, that's a good one. You know, I love those little dudes. When I lived out in Niskayuna, I used to walk on the on the bike path there off from Blatnik Park, and I would see them around this time of year. And the winter that we had of, I think it was either 14 or 15, I can't remember which, but it was a hideous winter. That month of February was the fourth coldest month on record, not the fourth coldest February, the fourth coldest month. And not only that, it was a very snowy winter. So, and I had seen a lot of those little buggers leading up to that. So that's how these things get going. And, you know, it is fascinating because you can read the folklore and everything else. The problem is when you're dealing with science, you have to have the weakest link in a lot of chains is you've got to have a good sample size. And certainly that does not qualify. So, you know, I love that kind of stuff. But in terms of nailing down any concrete predictions for the winter, I don't think that the woolly bear caterpillar quite gets it done.
But, I mean, it would be fairly simple for science to actually follow up on this. You do a census of the caterpillars, and then you see how the weather is. I mean, is there any truth to the cows lying down, it's going to rain? Has anybody looked into that?
I actually drove by a field of cows the other night. I'm sorry, not the other night. It was Sunday, and it was not raining, nor was it going to rain. And the cows were laying down. So I kind of debunked that myth right there, I guess, at least for that time.
Well, that's one data point, Jason. Come on now. All right, Mary.
That's right.
Mary
exactly.
Beth, you want to follow up or are you good?
I'm going to continue to look for more and hope for a warm winter.
Thank you very much for the call. Me too.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that, you know, we will talk about this a little bit more here in the next 30 minutes, but the overall winter forecast, I don't put a lot of stock into for this part of the country, because the one thing that people really care about here is snow, obviously. Cold is a second. Snow is the real driver. And we are coming into a La Nina year, which if you were going to place a bet on whether we would have, you know, if you wanted to bet, like, you know, in pro football or college football, you can bet the over and under on a total score of a game.
Yeah.
So if our average snow is 60 inches, two out of three times statistically, roughly, we would be under that total. But because we have a La Nina winter does not always equate to a less snowy winter. In fact, you know, if things line up right, we could get, you know, a couple of decent storms just like any other year. So it does lend itself to, again, if you're weighting averages heavily, it does equate to a less snowy and a milder winter, but does not mean that we are immune from either one of those. The dreaded polar vortex can certainly show up in La Nina years, actually, you know, with not a whole lot of regularity, but, you know, we could be humming along and have a week of 40s in December and then just have a brutal outbreak in January because the polar vortex decides to break off a bit and drift over us.
Jason Goff is our guest today. We talk weather every so often on this program. The number is 800-348-2551. If you would like to weigh in here on the program, let's talk about La Nina for a second before we get to the next call. How is it that something that occurs in the Pacific affects us all the way over here?
Well, you know, we kind of hit on that before when you brought up the good point about Epsilon. You know, it's all global. It really is.
But there's land.
You know, the ocean.
But there's a huge expanse of land between here and the Pacific.
There is, but you also have an even bigger expanse of water, a much bigger expanse of water, and you get those interactions between the atmosphere. I mean, basically, right, when you're looking at the planet Earth, you're looking at water, air, and land. And so you're getting interactions with the air and the water, and it does, you know, these ENSO patterns, as they're called, they do tend to shift jet streams, which has direct and indirect results on our, you know, on the weather that we have to deal with. So that's why in an El Nino year, you know, the probability of the West Coast getting more rain is there and more snow in the mountains too, obviously. So it's just, it's a global thing, man. That's the whole thing, the Earth. And that's why all of these discussions about climate change and everything, it's also important because everything is connected. If one place is really cold, someplace else is going to be really warm. The Earth is always balancing itself out.
Jason Goff joins us today, and back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Joel in Blooming Grove. Joel.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call, Ray and Jason. Jason, listen, you don't have to go south when you retire to find the warm weather. Stay where you are.
It'll come to you.
Because it's coming to you.
There you go.
The warm weather's coming up here. It's already here. And that brings me to my question. Do you consider global warming, climate change, an undeniable fact?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. As sure as I'm sitting here.
Okay. Now, I don't think all meteorologists and weather people on TV and radio actually do. And since there are so many millions of Americans who deny an undeniable fact, why can't the weather programs on TV and radio actually offer more education about global warming and climate change? You know, we need to be educated in this country if we want to survive. Thank you, and I will hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Joel, thanks a lot. All right, Jason.
That's good. No, he brings up a very good point, and it's interesting because I have been able to see in my career the evolution of this. The American Meteorological Society puts out a questionnaire every year, and they ask a lot of general questions of meteorologists, on air especially. And when I first started, I was in the minority that, you know, global warming and climate change were an actual thing and human beings were largely responsible for it. Thankfully, that is now the majority position. So I will say that there are groups out there and you can check out actually on jasonsweather.com. You can go and check out. I've got a whole page of all kinds of different climate things and global warming. If you go up to the Weather Library tab, and it just says global warming and climate. And I've put a lot of just different articles and things on there. But there's a group called Climate Central. They're based out of New Jersey, and they're great. And their mission is essentially to do what Joel was offering, and that is to help to educate people. Like, look, this is the deal. These are the data, and this is what's going on. And that is essentially what is continuing to go on. Now, as far as why television meteorologists don't offer up more of an explanation, it certainly can be done, but the TV business is really tight. And what I mean by that is that, you know, newscasts and things are pretty stringent in terms of the time that they have. So you've got to get through all of the content of the newscast. And then of course the advertising, which pays those bills. And so there's just generally not a lot of time for it. Now you can do special reports. I actually did a special report several years ago now that aired on Channel 13. I had a great time doing it, to kind of present what the deal is. But, you know, and then you also have groups, you know, you have the Sinclairs of the world, and, you know, they're doing what they can to kind of keep that stuff quashed because it doesn't fit into their philosophy, for example. So, you know, you've got that element that can be working against it. So it's still a delicate balance, but there are more resources out there now than there ever have been. And that is a very good thing.
Our guest today is meteorologist Jason Goff. The number is 800-348-2551. As we talk about the weather on Vox Pop today, Stephen in Gansevoort. Stephen.
Jason, Ray,
hey.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
So obviously, you know, cloud cover is a reflection of weather and a participant in weather. But having said that, with climate change and overall planetary temperatures rising, is there theorized that there is going to be a predictable, to some degree, change in the types of cloud cover that we're going to be seeing?
Well, clouds, certainly there are a lot of different types, but at their base, they need water, right? So as we get into a warmer atmosphere, the warmer a parcel of air is, you know, however large or small that parcel is, the more water vapor that it can hold. And so as you get into more of that, then it just kind of leads to more clouds. And there are other implications that are involved with that, with temperatures and what happens if you have clouds, especially at night, is that you tend to hold on to heat more. That's why this time of year, like, you know, Lake George and a lot of the lakes, they cool off in a hurry when you've got clear skies and, you know, temperature of 40 degrees. A lot of that heat radiates back off of the lake. And, the ground is similar as well. So when you've got clouds in place, they do tend to act as a blanket, and it keeps that heat in. So, you know, there are lots of implications as it relates to, you know, to warming in with clouds and everything else, certainly, yeah.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest. By the way, I forgot to mention this. A few weeks ago, we got one hellacious wind storm that rolled
yes.
through this area. My town, we were without power for several days, and it was I've not seen the like of that. I went into the Home Depot, and it was not too bad. I could see some clouds to the west, and by the time I was done in the Home Depot, the carts in the parking lot were moving like they were powered. It was incredible. What was that?
Oh, man, I'm surprised that we haven't gotten a call about that, Ray. So I'll go through this as quickly as I can. First of all, yeah, that's not something, obviously, that happens around here very often. That sucker was open for business. I was sitting at my desk as I am now, and, you know, we had thunderstorms in the forecast, and I'm starting to track this thing on my radar app, and it was out around Syracuse, and you could just see on the radar this continuing to develop. And not only that, there's a tool on the radar app that I have where you can calculate distance. So I calculated it, and actually, I mean, I'm fairly good at math, but I had to double check my math because I was like, that thing is moving at 68 miles an hour.
Wow.
Is that like, you know, I mean, I know from my training that that's possible, but when you see it and it's not in the forecast, you know, because this is not a typical time of year where you would see these types of things, which is called the derecho, by the way. We've talked about it on this program before. And so that is one of the signatures of these things. And it was continuing to develop. And I immediately got, I was like, okay, it's game on, man. And I was on Twitter. I was on Facebook just to let people know. And it was in and out of here. You're right. At, you know, 15 minutes, it was come and gone. And it was really, really something else. These types of storms are more typical in the summertime.
Yeah.
Again, like we were talking about before, because you want a lot of humidity, you want high dew points. You know, you typically will see these happen in and around heat waves, and they'll ride up over a big ridge somewhere or whatever, and they can travel literally over 1,000 miles. In fact, out in Iowa this year was probably the worst derecho on record. Out there was $7.5 billion in damage, by far the most damaging thunderstorm event in U.S. history.
Wow.
That was an extreme example. But there was another one, it was a few years ago, maybe now 5 or 6, that originated in the Midwest and made it all the way to D.C. and off the coast in like 12 hours. And that thing sustained its speed at about 70 miles an hour. So they are really something else. So for us to have to deal with that as we did, first of all, they're nearly impossible to forecast, especially in this particular case. Our dew points were in the low 50s. As I said, we did have thunderstorms in the forecast, but these things, it's kind of like, you know, that little game that you you spin it and the marbles all like fall into the little holes. You kind of need that sort of a shot in the dark, if you will, to get everything just right to have these things form. And essentially they feed off of each other. Not unlike a hurricane does in that sense, where a hurricane is sort of self-perpetuating, and these things kind of do the same, but it's really difficult to try to identify all of the elements in place to get it to do that. So you just kind of have to keep an eye on it, and certainly we did, and that thing came on through. But it was a specific type of derecho called a serial derecho, which, again, you would typically see more in the fall and spring.
Really, it was amazing. It was like a freight train just moving through, and it shocks me that a storm moving over land could keep power for that long. And you say there was one that went from the Midwest to D.C. That's a lot of land to cover.
Oh, man, you're not kidding. And to not only to be able to sustain itself, but to sustain itself at that speed all the way through that amount of time and at night. You know, oh, by the way, so you don't even have the added thermodynamics involved where the sun is heating the ground and all that stuff. You got plenty of humidity in place, as I said, you know, dew points in the 70s and all of that. But, you know, these things are rare anyway. I mean, we'll see a couple a year perhaps in the United States. But for us to get them here, they're rare. We've certainly had them before. We had a real nasty one in the mid-90s that came through the Adirondacks. And, you know, and all the way down through here as well, but it did an incredible amount of damage up there. But for us to have it in those conditions, again, with dew points in the low 50s, and, you know, it was just, we had just enough juice in the atmosphere to really kick this thing off and to keep it going, and it sure as heck did.
Let's take a quick break. Jason Goff is our guest. It's weather today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll hit the email bag and then back to the phones after this. Vox Pop, weather today with Jason Goff. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And Jason, a few emails have come in here. This one's from Mark. Mark writes, whenever we have a thunderstorm, I'm always afraid to talk on my cell phone. It seems like lightning strikes are more common these days, and I'm worried about getting struck. Is it true that you shouldn't use your cell phone during a thunderstorm? Does a cell phone call attract lightning? And that's from Mark.
No, sir. That's not something I would worry about. You know, certainly with landlines, that's a possibility. So if you were going to be, you know, certainly careful, you wouldn't want to use a landline. But obviously landlines are going the way of the dodo these days. So on a cell phone, you're okay, because there's just no wire to be able to transmit any electricity like that. So okay. If you're in the house, if you're in a safe space on your phone, on your cell phone, it's okay.
Fair enough. This one's from Joe, and Joe says, has this fall been more windy than usual?
Nope. I get questions like that every year. People, you know, they talk about the wind in the fall and in the spring as well. You know, this is a transitional season. We're going from the summer where everything really just kind of, you know, it kind of mirrors us humans, right? It just, everything slows down. It's nice and warm. It's quiet. It's this, it's that. And as we get into the fall, then, you know, the sun angle is going lower in the sky, and we are transitioning from summer to winter. And with that comes weather, and with weather comes wind. So this is a quite a typical setup. And, you know, and this week, and actually even in the next week too, we're dealing with oscillating fronts. We got a front that slipped through here now. It's now moving its way down through the mid and lower Hudson Valley. That's going to be coming back to the north. So it's going to be breezy and mild again tomorrow with the south wind. So it's typical fall weather. That's all it is.
All right. One more here from the email bag, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one's from Colleen. Colleen says, will smoke from wildfires out west impact the weather here?
They won't impact the weather, but they certainly are something to be seen. We had it over the summer and into the fall, into the earlier parts of the fall. We had those California and Colorado wildfires, and they were, you know, dotting the skies with those clouds. I shouldn't say dotting. They were kind of hazing the skies over, so bringing a lot of sunshine. I guess you could say that it would affect it in that it might lower our temperatures a little bit because we're not getting direct sun. It's being kind of filtered through the smoke particles. But in terms of having a direct impact on our weather or even our air quality, they don't, because they're up basically around the levels that you would find cirrus clouds at, up around 25 or so thousand feet.
Jason Goff is our guest, and back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Darren in Saratoga. Darren, you're on.
Hello, Ray and Jason.
Hi.
This is somewhat of a pet peeve. Why do meteorologists not forecast a quantity of rain when they forecast the probability of rain? For instance, if there's a 50% chance of rain forecast, why is it not stated if it's for 1/4 inch of rain or 3 drops per acre? Because that would be really helpful information.
Love it.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, because if you think about it, obviously we always forecast snowfall amounts, and you know, I'm just kind of thinking about this as I'm talking about it. Like, you know, you generally have people that care a lot more about snowfall amounts than rainfall amounts, because if we get, you know, a half an inch of rain or 1.5 inches of rain, it doesn't necessarily affect people as much as if you compared it to snow, unless you are relying on the outside weather to work. If you're a farmer, if you're a roofer or something like that, you know, obviously you would rather deal with lighter rain than heavier rain. I guess I never really thought about it like that, but you know, we just sort of qualify it as opposed to quantify it by just saying, you know, scattered showers or, you know, a steady heavy rain. And if we're going to get a bunch, like, you know, more than, in, you know, 2 inches, I generally will put that in my forecast and say, you know, hey, we can expect over 2 inches of rain, because then that does start to have implications on people, especially if they tend to have basement issues, you know, with heavy rains and things like that. So I guess it's just, you know, when you're a meteorologist to the public, the key is to be able to relate weather information to the majority of the people so that they just know what the weather is going to be and they can go on. And if you start to throw in more details, it tends to muddy the message.
Thanks, Darren, for the call. Is it very difficult to pin down, given the wide geographic region most broadcasters will broadcast to, isn't it kind of difficult to say, okay, you're going to get 1 inch of rain, or, oh, you'll get 6 inches of snow? It must be a crapshoot.
It is. It's difficult to do. And, you know, and when we do snow maps, and again, I keep drawing the comparisons because that's, it's a relatable thing. So, you know, when I draw my little snow contour maps, you know, where the Adirondacks are going to get this and the Berkshires are going to get that and the Hudson Valley is going to get this, you know, that's, it's never like completely spot on in terms of, you know, where that range is.
Yeah.
But ultimately what you are doing is, you're still forecasting what's known as precipitable water. And so what form that water is for the meteorological purposes doesn't really matter. It's, you know, because you'll say, okay, well, if we have our precipitable water amounts with a nor'easter coming up is going to be 1.5 inches, then, you know, we're going to get a bunch of snow.
Yeah.
So those two things are similar for sure.
Jason Goff is our guest. His website is jasonsweather.com. Let's go now to Michelle in Great Barrington. Michelle.
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Ray, I think you already asked the question I was going to ask about DiReggio's.
Oh,
so
I'm
can
sorry.
I ask a different question?
What the heck? Go
That's
ahead.
That's all right.
You sure?
It's a particularly vibrant fall color season this year, Jason. Is there any relation to the weather that we've been having and previous weather in the spring and summer that has an effect on the color of the leaves?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, and you generally, for to have good conditions, you want to have kind of not the exact amount that you need, but you want to have a decent amount of rain throughout the year. Remember, we had a few years ago, it was pretty dry and the colors of the trees were a little muted. You want to have, especially as we get into earlier in October, you want to have those cool nights and mild afternoons. That really tends to get things going. Ultimately, what drives the color or the loss of color, of the loss of green in the leaves, is the sun angle more than anything else. So, but in terms of the trees themselves, which are part of the ground, obviously, you know, you want them to be healthy and they're going to react to those fluctuations in temperatures. So it's been a great fall. The I Love New York folks always do a great job of putting out, you know, their foliage reports and things. And certainly now things are starting to wind down foliage wise, but it was a great year for us, so we've been in good shape. At least that's one good thing about 2020, you know?
Well, that might be it. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
We'll be very happy when this one is in the rearview mirror, I think. Let's go to Sandra and Adam. Sandra, you're on.
Hi there, guys. So about that incredible storm that ripped through the Berkshires about 2 weeks ago, it appears there were some sounds and sights that I have never heard and seen before. One thing, I thought it was thunder, and it turned out that it was this long rumbling noise that almost appeared to be moving, and it just wouldn't stop for numbers of seconds. When I came back in the house right after I heard that noise, there was then an enormous bang, and my entire building shook. Keeping in mind I live in an 8-unit apartment house, the entire building shook. I go back outside to discover that 1/3 of my 100-year-old maple tree branches had twisted off of the tree and slammed into the building. Yes. Here's the question. Mm-hmm. Lots of people were calling that event a microburst, and I'm not sure I know what that means. So what is a microburst, and could it have caused this enormous branch to twist right off of my tree?
Yes, it absolutely could have. The Weather Service, they went out and investigated this, and they did determine that there were some straight-line microbursts. There were, I know there was one EF0 tornado. There might have been two. I have that in my mind that they may have, because typically when you hear about things twisting, you know, that's a possibility, and the storm was so powerful. And it sounds weird to say, but, you know, for our purposes, for this particular system, whether there was a tornado or not doesn't really matter. I get that's one of the few times that you could ever say that with a straight face, but it was just such an incredible storm. And the rumbling that you heard was just the wind that was coming with this thing. It was like a freight train. I mean, this thing was really screaming through here.
It sounded like a train. So is a microburst, somebody said a microburst is a tornado that does not touch the ground.
No, that's not true. A microburst is essentially what happens is you have a lot of cold air that rushes out of the storm. And as I was saying before, this particular type of cluster of storms, it feeds on itself. So it's constantly dying and being reborn, if you will. So what happens with a microburst is you have a lot of cold air that comes rushing down from the top of the storm. It comes down at a big rate of speed, and it hits the ground. It can't go through the ground, so it's got to radiate out. And in this particular case, because of the type of system that this was, all of the microburst wind, instead of coming out radially, which is to say that it goes out in all directions, a lot of that wind was carried forward, which helped to really accelerate the wind speeds. And so that is it's a kind of a different type of a microburst. But again, it's at this point, it's semantics. You know, a 90 or 100 mile or 100 mile an hour wind is just that. It's just not something to be messed with.
Sandra, thanks so much for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest. Joe is in Canaan, Connecticut. Joe.
Hi. I'm a bit of a weather watcher. And many times I live in northwestern Connecticut, southern Berkshires, and I'm watching storms, you know, coming across New York, like heading right for us, you know, rather large storms. And in many, many cases, it seems that there's a line basically along the Hudson River Valley where the storms will be deflected or they'll actually dissipate. Understanding that storms could be literally miles high. And when you look at the Hudson River Valley and the mountains on the side of it, which only reach, you know, a couple of thousand feet at the most, how does that topography affect weather that's literally miles high?
Well, it's not to say that it deflects it, and I get at least a version of this question quite a bit, where people will say, you know, oh, I live in Boston Spa, or I live in Amsterdam, or I live in, you know, Granville in Washington County, and storms never hit us; they always split. Well, that's obviously not true. And so, you know, the storms, they have their own inner workings, if you will, and especially if they're not an organized cluster, like, you know, this obviously what we were just talking about is an extreme example of that. When you're talking about topography, you're talking more with respect to you can get different types of wind shear. So that becomes more relevant in our severe weather season and in the summertime and stuff like that. The tornado that hit Great Barrington in 1995 was studied by the Weather Service and by the Storm Prediction Center because there was an enhancement of the shear as that storm basically came out of the southern tier of New York and headed over. But in terms of any sort of you know, mountains kind of steering storms and all that sort of thing, that just doesn't happen. You know, these things are going to move where they're going to move, and they don't necessarily care so much about the topography. It's more about the steering winds and the other little things that are going on in the atmosphere as opposed to on the ground.
Well, that destroyed my theory.
Well, welcome to the club, Joe.
Hey, that's all right.
Thanks, man. Appreciate the call. Quickly over to Jillian and Troy. Jillian, you're up.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a 7-year-old who is very much into the weather and always checking the radar and always wants to know what's going on and lets his teachers know where they're going on vacation, what the weather will be like, and things like that. I was wondering if there was a good resource that you would recommend for kids to really dig in and learn much more about the weather.
Wow, that's great. Well, I'm very glad to hear that. It sounds like you have a budding meteorologist, because a lot of times we weather geeks, we get started early. And so that age is a good thing. There are a few different sites that I can steer you toward. And I'll tell you what they are, but I'll also give you my email address. You can email me and I can send you some links. You can just email me at jason@jasonsweather.com. But there are some really good sites out there. One of them is called, I'd have to verify, let me just look here real quickly. Weather Whiz Kids is one of them, although I don't see that in my favorites. But there are a few out there, so I'll be happy to share some links with you. Weather Whiz Kids is one. There's another site that's out of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, UIUC. That's a really good one. And then there's also a good book written by, and there are several editions now that are out, but Jack Williams is a, or was a, at least a writer for the USA Today, and he has a great book. It's very well illustrated, and it covers, I think that even, you know, a little guy would get something out of it, but even, you know, somebody that was in their 80s would get something out of it as well. It really does a good job of covering the broad spectrum of weather without going over anybody's head, but with also not being too elementary.
Okay. Well, Julia, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Alrighty, you're welcome.
Got this email here from John in Sullivan County. Jason, are you concerned or have any theories about the countless chemtrails that are seen all around the world? And that's from John. We only have about 30 seconds.
No, we have enough real problems in the world. I don't mean to be rude, but we have enough real problems in the world. I'm not worried about chemtrails.
All right.
That's all I can say about that.
All right, I'll tell you what, quickly to Bill in Hyde Park. Bill, you have about 15 seconds here.
You're kidding.
Well.
I had a long question about for you.
All right, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you email Jason. Jason, what's that email address again?
Jason@jasonsweather.com. You can email me.
Another satisfied customer. Well, thank you very much, Bill. All right, so Jason, it's always great to have you on this program. The weather's going to get real lousy in the next few months. We expect to see you again soon, yes?
Yes, and I would like to see you if that would be possible, but certainly if not, I'll be here over the phone lines, and I'm not forgetting about that bottle of scotch, Ray, so you got to make sure you understand that.
Fear not, brother, but right now we're still in our hazmat suit. So, you know, one of these days the pandemic will end. Hey, thanks for being here.
All right, Ray, thank you. Always enjoy it.
Talk to you soon. Support comes from Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, working to provide a healthy and safe environment, providing education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world, reopening 5 days a week in person, K-12, waldorfsaratoga.org for information. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Walton Landing, New York, providing more than 40 miles of trails for nature therapy and exploration beyond the shore of Lake George. HikeLakeGeorge.org. Once again, thanks to Jason Goff for being on the line with us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Matt Plummer took the calls. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the show, it's the Week in Review. And what a week it's been. And there'll be some more crazy weeks ahead, but we'll handle this one first. Judy Patrick joins us tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Capitol Connection.